You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Attention, comunidad, community. Knowing your rights isn't just important in these challenging times, it's essential. The ACLU and other regional organizations like Voces de la Frontera remind everyone, if ICE or law enforcement stops you, stay calm, do not run, and do not open your door unless they have a warrant signed by a judge. You have the right to remain silent and the right to refuse consent for a search. If you're detained, don't sign anything without speaking to a lawyer first. You have the right to call an attorney and request an interpreter. And remember, regardless of your immigration status, you have rights and the U.S. Constitution protects you. Spread the word, save the Voces de la Frontera hotline, 414-465-8078, or visit vdlf.org. Always carry a Know Your Rights card and be prepared. Visit aclu.org/knowyourrights for resources in English and Spanish. Stay informed, stay empowered, stay safe. This is WORT, your community radio station, bringing you the necessary information. Stay tuned, stay aware, and protect your rights. Information is power.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, April 20th edition of World View. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. And happy Easter to those who celebrate. Later in the program, we have an interview that Gil Halstead did with Cassandra Dixon last week. Cassandra returned on April 11th from more than a month in Masafer Yatta, the Hebron Hills of the Palestinian West Bank, and will give us an eyewitness report of what she saw and experienced while she was there. But first, we have the news.
Various memos circulating in the U.S. State Department and seen by major U.S. newspapers differ in the details, but all of them indicate a much reduced and restricted operation. The New York Times reported that the closures and reductions in the document it had seen would pare back the American presence on nearly every continent and cut nearly 50% of the State Department's spending. An early proposal from the White House Office of Management and Budget for the next fiscal year, seen by the Washington Post, would leave a total budget of $28.4 billion for all activities carried out by the State Department and USAID, once a separate agency, but that the Trump administration has said would become a part of the State Department. That's a decrease of $27 billion or 48% from funding levels approved by Congress for 2025. Just under 90% of funding to support international organizations are to be eliminated in this proposal, including that for the United Nations, NATO, and 20 other organizations would end. The White House budget proposal is due to be presented to Congress this month, and some aspects could face congressional opposition, especially the folding of USAID, a government agency created by Congress, into the State Department.
The U.S. State Department annual reports on international human rights, which are meant to inform congressional decisions on foreign aid allocations and security assistance, will no longer report on abuses of harsh prison conditions, government corruption, and restrictions on participation in the political process. The annual reports, officially called Country Reports on Human Rights Practices, are required by statute to be a, quote, full and complete report regarding the status of internationally recognized human rights, unquote. According to documents obtained by NPR, State Department employees have been directed to streamline the reports and limit them only to that which is legally required by, quote, recently issued executive orders, unquote. NPR said it confirmed the authenticity of a memo directing this change with two sources close to the process. The reports, normally released in March or April, are highly anticipated by foreign leaders and diplomats. The 2024 reports were completed in January, but have been re-edited by the new administration and are expected to be released in May. Among topics ordered to be struck from the reports are violence and discrimination against LGBTQ+ people, all references to DEI, involuntary or coercive medical or psychological practices, arbitrary or unlawful interference with privacy, serious restrictions to internet freedom, extensive gender-based violence, and violence or threats of violence targeting people with disabilities. The reports will include human rights specifically required by law, including war crimes and genocide, anti-Semitism, worker rights, and child marriage, and attacks on freedom of the press, with examples of these limited to one.
India continues to expand its arms manufacturing and exporting capabilities rapidly, even while it continues to be one of the largest importers of weapons. Over the past 10 years, the value of India's arms exports has grown by 21 times to $2.63 billion in the most recent fiscal year. Most of India's domestic production has been small arms, but they are expanding into more complex weapons. It was reported last week that the state-owned Export-Import Bank of India will begin to offer loans to arms customers that might otherwise have trouble financing purchases because of credit risks. The war in Ukraine has presented an opportunity for India's arms industry, as Western nations have sent their surplus arms to the conflict and Russia's arms production has been directed to its war effort. According to Indian officials who asked not to be identified, India will be increasing the number of its defense-oriented diplomats as part of a new program where the government will directly negotiate some arms deals, specifically targeting governments that have been longtime purchasers of Russian arms.
Indian students looking to study abroad are reacting to the new U.S. immigration policy being implemented by the Trump administration. Defunding of research programs, uncertainty, and restrictive visa enforcement are all having an impact. Sushil Sukhwani, founding director of an India-based study abroad consultancy, said, quote, compared to last year, we're anticipating a 20 to 20% fall in the number of Indian students going to the U.S. this year, unquote. According to the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, higher education is America's 10th largest export. The impact of international students on the U.S. economy is estimated at $44 billion, with the spending spread over many cities and towns. Community colleges enrolled nearly 60,000 international students in 2024, with China, Vietnam, and Nepal leading the countries of origin list. Edwin Van Rest, a CEO of Study Portals, talking about a report the company released last month, said, quote, the demand for foreign students looking to study a master's or PhD in the U.S. has dropped a dramatic 42% since the beginning of the year, unquote.
President Gustavo Petro of Colombia ordered the suspension of military operations against a faction of what was once the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, on Friday. The order will halt all military action in the region until May 18th in an effort to protect transit routes and agricultural operations. Earlier in the week, it was announced that a ceasefire between government forces and the FARC EP group would expire. The ceasefire had been in place since December of 2023 as part of Petro's efforts to end the deadly conflict with armed groups, which has lasted over 60 years and killed an estimated 450,000 people. Petro has indicated that although the ceasefire expired and no extension was agreed upon, it does not mark the end of peace talks with the group. As fighting continues with other FARC factions and armed guerrilla groups, security analysts say that peace talks hang in a very fragile balance.
Ecuador's leftist presidential candidate, Luisa Gonzalez, has announced plans to formally challenge the results of last Sunday's election after officials announced the victory of incumbent President Daniel Noboa. With nearly all ballots counted, the official tally shows Noboa leading by over 1 million votes, securing victory by a margin of 56% to 44%. Following the announcement of Noboa's victory, Gonzalez alleged that there was grotesque fraud and will submit a formal complaint to the country's election authority. Despite many members of her own party recognizing Noboa's victory, Gonzalez remains adamant that the election was illegally influenced by Noboa's unchecked presidential privileges during the election. She also alleged that many ballots contained irregularities and should be annulled. After the election, she stated, quote, "I denounce before my people, before the media, and before the world that Ecuador is experiencing a dictatorship and that we are facing the worst and most grotesque fraud in the history of the Republic of Ecuador," unquote.
Qatari Minister for Foreign Affairs Mohammed Al-Khulaifi affirmed his country's commitment to reviving an agreement to stop the ongoing genocide on the Palestinians in Gaza, despite the difficulties. He expressed Doha's concern about the slow pace of negotiations due to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's allegations of so-called Qatari incitement on American universities, unquote. Al-Khulaifi said he considers Netanyahu's repeated criticisms of Qatar to be mostly mere noise. Netanyahu stressed yesterday that he would not end the 19-month-long war of extermination against the Palestinian people in Gaza until what he described as the, quote, complete elimination of Hamas's civilian and military capabilities, unquote. Hamas is the Islamic resistance movement founded in 1987 as a Palestinian nationalist political organization with a military wing to fight the Israeli occupation of Palestine and bring attention to the Israeli governing system that is built on the Zionist vision. Hamas has governed the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip since 2007. Israel allowed Hamas to exist in order to maintain division within the Palestinian Authority's control of the Palestinian territories.
A member of the Iranian Parliament's National Security and Foreign Policy Committee, Mohammad Mehdi Shahriari, said his country has been in contact with the U.S. President Donald Trump's team for the past 2 years, well before Trump's second term. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi yesterday warned against hasty conclusions and unrealistic expectations in third-round talks scheduled to continue this week in Oman with the United States, while Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi will continue his role as mediator. Following the second round of talks in Rome with Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff, Araghchi said, quote, "There are no reasons for optimism or pessimism at this stage." According to the Iranian daily Etimad, Araghchi said that Tehran is taking a gradual approach to the talks and that results will only become apparent in subsequent rounds. The two sides agreed last Wednesday to continue technical negotiations focused primarily on uranium enrichment, one of the most contentious issues. Tehran has indicated its willingness to return to the agreed-upon upper limit, but only if economic sanctions are lifted in return. One of its key demands is the unfreezing of Iran's massive foreign assets, estimated at more than $100 billion. And those are our headlines for this week. Now here's Gil with our first longer story.
Russia's Supreme Court lifted the ban on dealing with the Taliban, the ruling party of Afghanistan, last Thursday. The Taliban had been designated a terrorist organization since 2003. The movement is the most recent in warming relations between the two countries. In October, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow will continue its course on developing political trade and economic ties with Kabul. Afghanistan and Russia have a complicated recent history, dating to 1979, when the Soviet Union supported the communist government in Afghanistan in a 10-year war against insurgents. Then, from 1999 to 2009, the Taliban supported Chechen rebels in their armed fight for independence from Russia, supplying money and weapons as well as diplomatic recognition. A major interest for Russia in improving relations with the Taliban is increased domestic security. In March of 2024, the Islamic State, a designated terrorist group, took responsibility for an attack in Moscow that killed 145 people and was believed to be the work of the Afghan branch of the organization. Afterwards, Russian leader Vladimir Putin described the Taliban as an ally in the fight against terrorism. The Russian Foreign Ministry said in a statement, quote, Russia aims to build mutually beneficial ties with Afghanistan in all areas, including the fight against drugs and terrorism, unquote. Economic and political interests are also at stake. As Russia sees Afghanistan as an important hub for exporting its gas to Southeast Asia, Russia is also interested in regional political influence, as the Taliban has been in the process of normalizing its relations with other Asian countries, including India, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan. Although no country formally recognizes the Taliban, China appointed an ambassador to Kabul in 2023. Western nations are still reluctant to interact with the Taliban government based on its human rights record, especially the restrictions placed on women in Afghanistan.
China's ambassador to the United States, Chie Fang, spoke publicly yesterday about the current trade conflict between the two countries, saying, quote, the earth is big enough to accommodate both China and the U.S. We should pursue peaceful coexistence rather than collide head-on and help each other succeed rather than get caught in a lose-lose scenario, unquote. On Friday, President Trump told reporters at the White House, quote, we have nice conversations going with China. It's like really very good, unquote, without offering further detail. Ambassador Xie's comments posted on the Chinese embassy's website also said, quote, if any country insists on imposing tariff war or trade war on us, we will definitely face it fearlessly and take resolute countermeasures, unquote. He also said, quote, China's development will continue to be an opportunity for the whole world. We will continue to open rather than close our doors, tear down rather than erect barriers, empower the world rather than focus solely on self-interest, unquote. The president of China, Xi Jinping, this week had three friendly state visits to Vietnam, Malaysia, and Cambodia, all nations impacted by U.S. tariffs. Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim said, quote, what we are witnessing today is not an honest reckoning with the imperfections of globalization, but a retreat into economic tribalism. Market access is being weaponized. In these trying times, the world yearns for steadiness, reliability, and a common purpose. We see this in China's conduct, unquote. On Tuesday, President Trump criticized China on social media when it was reported that the Chinese government ordered its airlines to no longer take delivery of airplanes previously ordered from U.S. aircraft builder Boeing. At the same time, the U.S. has restricted the export of an advanced computer chip made by U.S. company NVIDIA to China. The Chinese Ministry of Commerce has announced that it will work with its export manufacturing sector to help sell products in China that may no longer be going abroad due to tariffs. A statement from the ministry on Friday said, quote, "The domestic market offers strong backing for enterprises involved in foreign trade," unquote. However, replacing all of the potential lost foreign demand with domestic consumption will be difficult for China.
Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen traveled to El Salvador this week to press for the release of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, a Maryland father who was mistakenly deported by the Trump administration last month. Abrego Garcia was imprisoned in El Salvador's notorious Center for the Confinement of Terrorism, or CECOT, despite U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials acknowledging that his deportation was a, quote, administrative error, unquote. Multiple federal judges, including a unanimous Supreme Court ruling, have ordered the Trump administration to facilitate his release and return to the U.S., but the Trump administration has given no indication that it will comply. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said, quote, "If he ever ends up back in the United States, he would immediately be deported again," unquote. The Trump administration has defended the deportation by claiming that he is a member of a transnational Salvadoran gang, MS-13. Abrego Garcia has never been charged with a gang-related crime. In a news conference at Washington Dulles International Airport, Van Hollen said, quote, "It's about protecting the constitutional rights of everybody who resides in the United States. It's very clear that the president, the Trump administration, are blatantly, flagrantly disagreeing with and defying the order from the Supreme Court," unquote. Van Hollen reported that Abrego Garcia was transferred from CECOT to a new prison in the city of Santa Ana, where conditions are better. President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador has also expressed no intention of facilitating his release, saying that the prisoner, quote, "gets the honor of staying in El Salvador's custody," unquote. Since March, more than 200 Venezuelan migrants accused of gang-related activity have been sent from the U.S. to be held in CECOT.
According to a report released by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, a multi-partner UN initiative, more than half of Haiti's population will experience severe hunger through June. The report estimates that the number of Haitians facing severe hunger has increased to 5.7 million as gang violence continues to grip the country and access to humanitarian aid dwindles. From August 2024 to February 2025, it's estimated that nearly 1 million Haitians were receiving humanitarian food aid monthly. The report states that in many cases, rations have been reduced by up to half due to lack of funding after U.S. President Donald Trump reduced 90% of USAID foreign aid contracts. The issue of food insecurity is particularly critical for many Haitians who have been displaced and are living in makeshift shelters. Jackie Jean-Jacques, along with his wife and three children, are among those who lost their homes and livelihoods to gang violence. He said, quote, "There are days where the kids have to live on sugar water and bread. It hurts me to see that," unquote. Haitians have also been surging food prices, with inflation reaching 30% in recent months. According to the UN World Food Programme, or WFP, it needs $53.7 million to, quote, "continue its life-saving operation in Haiti over the next 6 months," unquote. In a statement released on Thursday, Juan Jacaria, WFP's country director in Haiti, said, quote, "Right now, we're fighting just to hold the line on hunger," unquote. with Haiti's temporary government unable to effectively address the issue of gang violence in the country, international humanitarian and security support in the coming months will be crucial for those impacted by the conflict.
The families of Israeli prisoners remaining in the Palestinian Gaza Strip accused Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of abandoning their sons and prolonging the war to serve his political interests. They warned of the diminishing chances of the return of hostages alive and the army's failure to resolve the battle issue inside the Gaza Strip. Netanyahu said that those who support ending the war are harming efforts to return the prisoners, unquote, and claimed in his recent speech that if Hamas's rule is not eliminated, a repeat of what happened on October 7, 2023 is, quote, a matter of time, unquote. Khalil al-Hayya, head of the Islamic resistance movement Hamas in the Gaza Strip, announced his readiness to immediately begin comprehensive package negotiations to release all Israeli prisoners in exchange for an agreed-upon number of Palestinian prisoners, a complete cessation of hostilities, a full withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, the start of reconstruction, and an end to the almost two decades-long Israeli blockade of Gaza. Israeli sources estimate that there are 59 Israeli prisoners in the Gaza Strip, 24 of whom are still alive. Meanwhile, more than 9,500 Palestinian captives, including children, are languishing in Israeli prisons, suffering from torture, sexual violence, starvation, and medical neglect. Many prisoners have died, according to Palestinian and Israeli human rights organizations and media reports. The first phase of a ceasefire and prisoner exchange agreement between Hamas and Israel began on January 19th of this year and concluded in early March. The agreement was brokered by Egypt and Qatar and supported by the United States, and the Palestinian movement adhered to it. Netanyahu, who is wanted for trial by the International Court of Justice, evaded the start of the second phase and resumed the genocide in the Gaza Strip on March 18th, responding to the most extreme faction in his right-wing government, according to Hebrew media. With American support, Israel has continued to commit genocidal crimes in Gaza since October 7, 2023, resulting in approximately 168,000 deaths and injuries, the majority of whom are children and women. In addition, there are more than 11,000 missing persons.
The U.S. Department of Defense is working to reduce the number of its military personnel deployed in Syria to less than approximately 1,000 troops in the coming months. The U.S. Secretary of Defense last week directed the integration of U.S. forces into Syria through select locations without specifying the locations. This move is part of President Trump's commitment to, quote, peace through strength, unquote, while U.S. Central Command was directed to strike remnants of Islamic State in Syria, or ISIS, in Syria. ISIS seized vast swaths of territory in Syria and neighboring Iraq more than a decade ago before suffering defeats in both countries. Trump questioned the effectiveness of the U.S. troop presence in Syria and ordered their withdrawal during his first term, but he eventually reversed his decision. While Islamist-led opposition factions ousted President Bashar al-Assad in a lightning offensive last December, Trump said at the time that Washington should not be involved. The newly elected Trump said, quote, Syria is a mess, but it is not our friend, and the United States should not be involved. This is not our fight, unquote. Israel, seen in the region as an extension of the U.S., maintains military power to keep Syria divided and weak. A deadly attack by ISIS fighters in 2014 prompted the United States to launch an air campaign in support of Iraqi government units and the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces that confronted the jihadists. Jihadi in Arabic means struggling with a praiseworthy aim. The Syrian Democratic Forces declared the defeat of ISIS in March 2019 after capturing the last ISIS stronghold in Syria. The so-called jihadists still have some fighters in the Syrian countryside, and U.S. forces have carried out periodic strikes and raids to prevent the group's resurgence. The U.S. intensified its military action against ISIS in Syria following the recent ouster of President Bashar al-Assad. And that's a wrap of the news from around the world for Sunday, April 20th, 2025. I'm Lee Rowe.
And I'm Gil Halstead.
Sources we used to prepare today's stories were Al Jazeera, All Africa, Anadolu, the Associated Press, the BBC, CNN, Economic Times, Deutsche Welle, France 24, The Guardian, IRNA, The Miami Herald, Middle East Eye, Middle East Monitor, NPR, The New York Times, People's Dispatch, Radio Free Asia, Reuters, Sana, and The Washington Post.
Welcome to the April 20th, 2025 edition of the Worldview feature. I'm your host, Gil Halstead. Today, we are joined by longtime Madison peace activist Cassandra Dixon. She's just returned from spending time in the Hebron Hills of Palestine, an area where Palestinian villagers have been under increased attacks by both the Israeli Defense Forces and militant Israeli settlers. Cassandra has been spending time every year in this part of Palestine for, it seems to me, the past decade or so, working with international solidarity groups who do their best to protect Palestinian villagers nonviolently from attacks like the ones we'll be talking with Cassandra about. Cassandra, welcome back to Worldview.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Cassandra, I want to talk to you about an attack that took place a couple of weeks ago in the village of Jinba, not far from where you have been spending time in the Hebron Hills. It was reported on by Al Jazeera, and we'll include a link to that story when we post this interview with you on the WORT webpage. You were probably in this area where this happened and maybe can tell us more about it. According to the story, a group of settlers attacked three people in Jinba and beat one young boy severely. Another boy was arrested for allegedly throwing stones, which he denied doing. And according to the Al Jazeera story, he was held for several hours and interrogated and then released. One of the young victims was beaten severely on the head. As has reportedly happened in many of these attacks, the victims end up being arrested and the perpetrators, the settlers or the army, are not charged. The Al Jazeera story cites information from the Israeli human rights group Yesh Din that claims that only 3% of attacks on Palestinian villagers by settlers are reported to the police and ever result in convictions for the attackers. That statistic is based on a review of 1,700 complaints brought by villagers to the police against settlers over the past 20 years. So what's the context right now in which that is happening that you've seen when you've been there most recently?
So the attacks are shocking individually, but also shocking is the fact that they are so constant and repeated. There have been multiple attacks since I returned. I've only been back since Friday. There were multiple attacks when I was there. And so as a result, people are living in pretty much constant fear of that happening. And it's not a fear that you can talk yourself out of, because it's so real, the fact that they may well be there next. So when that attack in the village of Jinba happened, I was actually on the phone with my friend Ali, who I think you've had on Worldview many times before. And he was hearing about it from frantic calls from part of his family that lives in the village of Jinba. He lives in the village of Touba. And he was awake all night watching out for the village of Touba, so expecting an attack in one place and hearing it happening to members of your family that live in another place. This is like, it's hellacious. It's unbelievable to us, right? But it's happening with such increasing frequency that it's, you can't say that it's becoming the norm, but it's so frequent that it's a lived with fact for people all of the time. And the coverage on the village of the attack on Susia got a little bit of media coverage here because the co-director of an Oscar winning film was beaten and kidnapped and arrested within that attack and seriously injured. But the dozens and dozens and dozens of these attacks that happen completely without the world paying any attention really is fueling the attacks themselves. So settlers at this point, there are about 700,000 settlers living in the West Bank in settlements which are all illegal under international law and in outposts which are illegal even under Israeli law. However, there is absolutely nothing done to police the actions of those settlers that are living in those settlements or to limit the construction of new settlements. So there are new outposts throughout Nusafriyatta now dividing the villages. So villages where people used to be able to walk from one village to another or travel by donkey, they are not able to do that now because the risk of traveling by foot or by donkey in those areas is it's so dangerous that people can't take that risk anymore. So people are very much cut off. When these attacks do happen, for instance, the attack in Jimba is located in an area of Nusafriyatta that Israel claims as a firing zone. And so they have made it illegal for anyone to be in that zone, which includes 12 villages and thousands of people living there, but only the people who have IDs that are numbered that identify them as residents of that area can be there, and anyone else is threatened with arrest immediately. And only vehicles which are registered to residents are allowed to be in the area, and other vehicles are confiscated immediately. So it took a very long time for the ambulances to reach them. The road has been destroyed multiple times by settlers and the military and is nearly impassable. I mean, all of these roads have been so damaged that by our standards, they're not even roads. So Ahmed laid knocked out on the ground for nearly an hour before the ambulance could reach him, which he had a skull injury, as did his cousin. So with those injuries, getting fast medical attention is crucial to the person healing. He has some probably lasting brain damage and also really severe psychological damage. He's in a state where it's very, very difficult for him to communicate with people or talk with people. And he's getting some care now from a Doctors Without Borders organization there that provides some psychosocial support for people. But the reality is that there's no way to recover from that traumatic stress incident because there is no post-traumatic stress in Palestine. There is no later, there's no post, there's only the understanding that this can happen again anytime. It can happen to you, it can happen to your younger siblings, it can happen to your mother, it can happen to your family that lives, the part of your family that lives in a slightly different place that you're not always with. It can happen to you while you're traveling, it can happen while you're sleeping. So there is no way for people to recover from these things, and there's no end to this. One of the things that's happened also since the 7th of October is the collusion between the Israeli military and the settlers has greatly grown. So it has always been the case, and these settler attacks were occurring. They have been occurring for decades. This is not a new thing, but the frequency of them is increased. And the obviousness of the collusion between the settlers and the military is now completely a publicly flaunted phenomenon. So settlers, I witnessed attacks where settlers attacked people and then ran back to a vehicle, changed clothes into clothing that sort of mimics army clothing and re-arrived as settlers, as armed settlers, and arrested the people that they had attacked. So there are groups now of Israeli settlers that have formed into what I would call paramilitary units. They have no accountability to anyone. However, they are armed by the Israeli state and they function as functioning soldiers. They're recognized by the military as as soldiers. So those people have completely free reign. They are settlers themselves. They share, especially the settlers in the Musafiryatta area, share a very ideologically driven agenda that calls for removing all Palestinians from the area. Many of them, both the organizations and the individuals, have been sanctioned both by the U.S. and internationally, although one of the first moves of Donald Trump was to lift the sanctions on all of those people. So people who are causing these type of injuries to children, apparently now we are absolutely fine with that as an international community. And it's devastating to people living in these areas to be trying to survive this with the feeling that no one cares, no one is watching, no one cares to watch. And if anyone does see this, they do nothing. So our U.S. State Department has a presence there, but absolutely refuses to respond to these incidents, even though we are funding the Israeli military, which is funding the settlers. I mean, this is our tax dollars involved in these attacks. One of the things that happened when I was there is that the settlers in that area were gifted with 19 brand new four-wheeled ATVs. And they use these ATVs to quickly approach, like these are vehicles that are made for this terrain. They can go anywhere, roads or no, so that they can arrive in a mass in a village in an instant. In the incident in Jimba, they had some video footage of a settler arriving on an ATV. Usually settlers will then claim that someone has attacked them. In this case, they have someone from afar, someone who was out with sheep, had the presence of mind to record the entire thing from a distance so that you can see that there was absolutely no provocation, that these people came fast and furious with the intent to cause as much damage as they could. So one thing that's not in that Al Jazeera story is the aftermath of that. So people endured this hellacious attack. And then the next day, the military arrived in Jimba. And the military destroyed the contents of all of the buildings. They destroyed households. They destroyed the interior of the school. They broke into it through the windows. They destroyed the mosque. They destroyed the clinic. They destroyed animal pens. They destroyed animal feed stores. They destroyed people's food. They had multiple crews of soldiers. They issued each of them with heavy sledgehammers, 20-pound sledgehammers, and they absolutely destroyed the contents of all of those buildings. So the school, which has been built over many years, walking into there was like walking into a place that had been hit with a cyclone. There was not one thing intact. The children's desks and their schoolwork and their art projects and absolutely everything was just completely strewn on the floor. And that was also true in people's houses. They broke into houses. They forced families outside, grouped them in an area, and completely destroyed the contents of the homes. So that was the day after this horrendous, violent settler attack. And that was the military that did that. That's this extremely moral army, which we seem to insist on funding, using and threatening people with weapons that we have paid for with our tax dollars. And this, I mean, I'm grateful that this attack got some coverage. I'm glad that we know about it. I'm glad that we have the chance to try to hold our elected officials accountable for the results of our blanket support of Israel in this time. But it's not enough. The frequency of these incidents is shocking. And they're happening not just in Musafiryatta, but throughout the West Bank. They're ramping up continuously. Like, I think every month there are more attacks than there were the previous month. So there have been 876 people killed in the West Bank and 180 of them children. Over 40,000 people have been displaced. So there are entire cities and more than 55 villages that have been completely erased. The villages due to this violence where people have been unable to sustain. I mean, at some point, it's impossible to have children continuing to live in these villages when there is no way to protect them. And eventually people have had to leave because they also have no way to make a living. These are villages that survived by herding sheep and goats, owning herds of sheep and goats. And these settler attacks have included the theft of all of the sheep of multiple families, the repeated theft of livestock, even if they're replaced, thefts of donkeys, destruction of water supplies so that it's not possible to have water for those herds of sheep, and also making it completely impossible for anyone to be out with sheep because it's too dangerous to be out with a herd of sheep. And simultaneously, these settlers have increased the use of herds of their own sheep and goats that have been weaponized as a way of destroying crops and also of occupying land. So they will arrive with a large herd of sheep and goats. They will allow those sheep and goats to eat all of the crops that were planted the year before on which the villagers' sheep should be grazing right now. So that's a huge economic loss, especially given the fact that they also are going to attack and prevent the delivery of any replacement food for that livestock. They also, by their presence, by being there and being armed both with weaponry and also with serious clubs and sticks, they make it impossible for people to dare to remain on their own land daily and nightly, make it impossible for people to remain in their own homes. There have been 1,800 structures destroyed in the West Bank since 7 October. There are also 9,900 political prisoners being held in the West Bank right now, more than 5,000 of them with no charges. So that's a very frequent aftermath of these settler attacks, including in Jimba. There were 22 people arrested when the military arrived the following day and destroyed all of the contents of the buildings. So some of those people were released later that night, just dropped somewhere where they had no idea where they were, no phones, no actual way to get home. Some of them were held for several days, and in the end, 7 of them were forced to pay bonds of $5,000 apiece in order to be released. They were never charged with a crime. They were never charged with anything, but they were forced to pay that bail, which so the amount, combined amount, was $35,000. It's a huge amount of money for a tiny village that survives by herding some sheep and goats, and really not possible for those people to raise that money on their own if they weren't able to appeal to people in other villages to help them. But the problem now is that so many people are being attacked that there's very little ability really to support each other because everyone is struggling so hard with their own situation. So if this is a situation that I don't understand how people are surviving it, really, except for the fact that people have absolutely no choice. And being there during this time, driving around, there people would point out to me like, okay, this is where this village was and this is where that village was. And you look out the window and you see nothing, because after people have been driven from their lands by this violence, settlers have returned and destroyed everything so that it's not possible. Even if people do find some support to try to come back and face that violence, it's not possible for them to do that because everything has been destroyed. While I was there in the village of Zenuda, which is one of the depopulated villages, there was a major effort to return there. So they coordinated with activists throughout the area and also international activists and Israeli peace activists to try to provide enough protective presence for people to go in and try to start rebuilding, able to move back. But it's a situation where they're not spending nights there yet, and they're not spending any time working there yet without without someone standing at the entrance to the village.
We're speaking with Cassandra Dixon, Madison area peace activist, just returned recently from the West Bank, from the Hebron Hills, describing, as you've been hearing, the horrific things that have been going on there while she was there. And Cassandra, I want to ask you this description of the attack that just happened 2 weeks ago, and who knows, there probably have been others since then. You mentioned that Doctors Without Borders were able to provide some medical care for the victims in that attack and maybe from others. How, in the way you've described how difficult it is for this residents of the village there to move around and carry on their daily lives, how is it that you or other volunteers like yourself or Doctors Without Borders are able to, the Israeli government allows you in and out of this area? How does that work?
No, right. Well, we were in a village close to Jimbo when that happened, and we spent the group of us, the small Italian NGO that I work with, the entirety of the rest day trying to get there, and we were not able to. So one of the things that was also destroyed there was all of the cars. So that meant that there were no vehicles that were legally able to be on those roads. And so it meant that even though, like, we would have wanted to try to get supplies and go to help, but that it was not possible to go because we would have been arrested the moment we entered the firing zone, and we would not have been successful in reaching there. So they eventually did succeed, and I think that this Al Jazeera reporter or someone from Al Jazeera, I'm sure, was there at the time. They did succeed in bringing a group of reporters. They had some Israeli reporters that went, and I think that they were able to just have a big enough group of journalists that they kind of brazened that out. And those journalists must have known that it was a possibility that they would be arrested, but they weren't. So they were able to go and interview some people and come back in a vehicle from outside. But in general, it's not. So that's why these villages are so vulnerable. For instance, our friend Ali, right, his car was destroyed in an attack on his village about a month ago. And he's a person who would have carried people there to Jimba to help, but was unable to do that because his car had been destroyed. So he's also a resident of the firing zone, and his car would have been able to, they would have had to, by their own restrictions, they would have had to let it pass. But it was torched by settlers who dropped a bottle of burning gasoline into it, actually while Ali was in the car. So that car is no longer, and the process of replacing that car is a long process. So it's difficult to raise the money for it. It's also hard to find a used car that's legal and that can withstand those roads. So it's very, very difficult. And that whole ability to hide what's going on is definitely part of, I mean, that's why it's been made illegal to spend time there. So years ago, when I was in that area, I spent considerable time in Jimba and spent time with school kids. I learned how to milk sheep in the village of Jimba. I remember a couple of trips that they had organized for kids to go into the city to, a fun cultural day. And their travels out of there even then involved a very dangerous path past a settlement. And the village that's actually was closest to that settlement is one of the ones that's disappeared now. But they had asked for international accompaniment for the kids who had to walk up this very long, like the kids started at like 5:30 in the morning to walk up this road to try to meet a school bus at about 9. And that whole path was fraught for them. And fortunately, nothing happened that time. But now what they did at that time is completely impossible. No one would consider trying to make that road by foot now because the potential for attack is so extreme.
So, Cassandra, we only have a few minutes left in the program for today. So I want to ask you, how can people who've heard what's going on there now do something to help out, to sort of take responsibility for the role that our government is playing there in supporting both the settlements and the Israeli military? What can be done?
Well, there are a couple of things coming up. I encourage people to think about donating an olive tree. Madison Rafa Sister City Project has partnered with a Dutch organization to replace trees that are destroyed in these attacks. And they're very, very important for people to be able to do that because it proves that they are using their land. And the trees work as a way of hanging on to agricultural land and also as a way of providing some short-term jobs and funding to replace the trees that settlers have destroyed in the hope that those trees will actually produce. So if people are interested in that, you can sponsor a tree for just about $20. And really easily. So you can go to tiny.one/Madison Olive Grove. And you can also find that and other ways to get involved if you would like to visit the website of Madison Rafa Sister City Project at madisonrafa.org. And Madison Rafa is hosting a Palestine Solidarity Fair coming up on Saturday, May 3rd. It's at the Friends Meeting House, which is at 1704 Roberts Court. from 2 to 4:30. So there will be crafts, olive oil, soap, books, Palestinian children's books for sale by Rumon Fuenzon, crafts from the city of Achalil or Hebron from a women's cooperative there. There will be children's stories and crafts to do. There will be food, a chance to taste some recipes from Gaza and eat some treats, sweet treats from Palestine, presentations from Palestinian youth from Madison and literature and also some bookmaking from the Cartonera Project, which is a really wonderful project all in itself of making some books with cardboard covers that are decorated individually by people, not people who necessarily define themselves as artists, but the art that's inside of all of us and contains stories and information from Palestine. So I encourage you, if you're free on May 3rd, that event is open to the public and is free. Friends Meeting House is near to Trader Joe's, just off Monroe Street. There is some limited parking at the Meeting House, but there's also parking available on the side streets on Monroe Street and actually also at Trader Joe's. So MadisonRaffa.org, which a good spot to go for the details on that and other things that Madison Raffa is involved in locally. And also, I continue to make calls to my elected officials, and I know how frustrating this is, but as long as we continue to call ourselves a democracy and as long as we continue to send these enormous amounts of money to a state that is sponsoring this level of violence right now, we need to keep making sure that our voices are heard. We need to make sure that we're continuing to tell our elected officials from both parties that Palestine is an essential issue to us and that we are not all right with the genocide that is still being committed in our name with our tax dollars. That I think that anything that we can do to keep speaking out is very, very important. One legislative thing happening in the state is an effort to repeal a law that actually is making and engaging in boycotts illegal. So that's something that I encourage people to let their state elected officials know their feelings about that. Support our right to boycott. It's an age-old nonviolent means of change that we should not allow ourselves to be deprived of. So also at MadisonRaffa.org, you can find more information about that. And lastly, I really encourage you to read, to follow news sources, to listen to WORT, listen to reporting, especially reporting from Palestinian sources. Put Al Jazeera on your phone and absorb that news, because these are incidents that are happening with our tacit approval if we don't engage. And if we don't know what's happening, there's not much we can do about it. So we need to learn, we need to inform ourselves, and we need to talk to each other and understand the level of violence and genocide that's happening in our name, perpetrated by the state of Israel.
Cassandra Dixon, thanks so much for speaking with us, for finding the time to talk with us about your work and what's been going on in Palestine.
And that's Worldview for this week. Our most sincere gratitude to Cassandra Dixon for her report on recent events and conditions in the West Bank. We'll be posting the interview on the WORT webpage, along with the resources that Cassandra mentioned. And the best way to get information about Palestine is the Madison Raffa Sister City Project webpage, which is Madison Raffa, R-A-F-A-H is Raffa, MadisonRaffa.org. And thank you to the Worldview Collective members, Neil Adams, Sabia Tia, Chuck Benish, Andrew Karn, Gil Halstead, and Amitabh Paul, for bringing international news to WORT listeners. Thanks also to WORT News and Public Affairs Director, Shali Pittman. And we especially thank you for listening. Please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-sponsored radio, WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org, or on the app. And now, stay tuned for Salamat. Thank you.
Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
السلام عليكم. طب اسم